All right, 2 Chronicles chapter 12, and it has been a bit of a hiatus from our study here, so we're getting back to that now, and since it has been a while since we've been in here together, we want to take a moment to review, but this part of 2 Chronicles is telling us or teaching us about the things that were going on with Solomon's son Rehoboam and with his kingdom Judah during the time of his reign. And that actually goes back to the previous chapter. So we have chapters 11 and 12 covering the reign of Rehoboam. Now there was a little bit about that we saw at the end of 1 Kings chapter 14, a few verses there. But not near the amount in terms of volume of material in 1 Kings 14 that we find here in 2 Chronicles 11 and 12. As we've noted, 1 Kings is primarily focused upon, and this is also true of 2 Kings up until chapter 17 of that book, but from 1 Kings, really from 1 Kings chapter 12 through 2 Kings 17, the primary focus there on the kings of Israel, the northern kingdom after the split. I mean, obviously, before that point, there was one kingdom under Saul and then David and then Solomon. And so we don't have that situation where there's things going on in two different kingdoms within the same nation of Israel like we do at this point. So 1 and 2 Kings is mainly focused on the northern kingdom of Israel, whereas 2 Chronicles is mostly focused upon what's going on in Judah, the southern kingdom. There's obviously some overlap, and we will see some things mentioned of the nation or the other kingdom in each book, but that's the general setup there, the way the Lord has organize the material. So that's why right now we're in 2 Chronicles, having already looked at what is in 1 Kings concerning Jeroboam, who was the first king of the northern kingdom. After Solomon's death, the kingdom split. So we had Jeroboam, first king of the 10 tribes in the north, and then Rehoboam reigning as king over his tribe Judah with Benjamin with him. All right, so in chapter 11, we saw that when Rehoboam became king and the circumstances of that as when Solomon died and he listened to his younger advisors who counseled him to speak roughly to the people when they wanted him to agree. The tribes wanted him to agree to be milder with them, with a lighter burden than what they carried under Solomon. And he listened to his younger advisors and spoke roughly to them. And so the 10 tribes in the north said, "We're not going to follow you." And they anointed Jeroboam to be their king. And Rehoboam was going to send the soldiers, his army, to fight with them. And so that was would have been a great what we would call a civil war in Israel, but God forbade that because he said it was from him. This is what he had prophesied would happen in Solomon's, late in Solomon's life, as this was partly punishment for what Solomon had done when his wives turned his heart away from the Lord to idols. We know he repented from that, but also the people of Israel went with him in that. And so the people of Israel had worshipped idols also. And that was mentioned when God made that prophecy about what he was going to do in dividing the kingdom, that it was also to punish the nation. So this was from the Lord. And so Rehoboam did listen to God, and he obeyed him in his instruction not to fight a war to try to reunify the kingdom. Not that there was not conflict between Jeroboam and Rehoboam. There was throughout their reigns when they were both alive together, but this major war was averted there at the outset. So then it told us in 2 Chronicles chapter 11, the organization of his kingdom, and particularly that the righteous people from the northern kingdom, both of the priests and Levites, as well as those of the other tribes, the ones who loved the Lord and desired to serve the Lord, they left that northern kingdom and strengthened Rehoboam's kingdom. Well, they left because Jeroboam had instituted a new religion in his kingdom that prohibited them from following the Lord's commandments. He forbade them from going to Jerusalem. So there were things he told them they couldn't do that God had commanded them to do, like go to Jerusalem three times a year. He didn't want them going down there where Rehoboam was. But on the other hand, or in addition to that, he also commanded them to do certain things that the Lord had forbidden and many other things that God had not authorized. He made those two golden calves and called them their gods, put one in Dan and one in Bethel at either end of the kingdom, and told them to worship those calves, made up his own altars, feast days, priests, all of that. And that's what we had read earlier in 1 Kings, starting at the end of chapter 12 and on into chapter 13 and 14, when God sent a prophet to rebuke him. Then the punishment started coming in chapter 14 of 1 Kings, when his son fell ill, and again prophesied that the destruction of his house because he would not repent of those sins. But anybody living in the northern kingdom at that time would have been compelled to have followed things that were sinful and would have been forbidden from doing what God had commanded, what was right. So how could you stay there and be right with God? Well, they couldn't, so they had to leave. They had to leave their inheritance. They had to leave their homes and families and all of those things and start over, moving to the southern kingdom. But that's what the ones who were seeking God did. And so that was to the benefit of Rehoboam and his kingdom as it strengthened his kingdom. But then we read that verse in 2 Chronicles 11:17 telling us or giving us a preview of what we get into in chapter 12 and have already started to see the details about. That Rehoboam forsook the Lord, but that was after 3 years, because it says in 2 Chronicles 11 and verse 17, for 3 years they walked in the way of David and Solomon. So there were 3 good years there, and the Lord blessed them in every way. They were strengthened. They were able to have the defenses against their enemies. There was no problems with them. So everything was going well with Rehoboam and his kingdom for those 3 years. Apparently he felt like that needed to change. He changed the circumstances of his kingdom and the only way that it could have been. And that was by forsaking the Lord. So everything was going well as he was seeking and following God, but then he turned away. We explored some of the reasons there, the influences that were there that were told about at the end of chapter 11. There was a lot there about Rehoboam's family background. What was his mother? What was her background?
She was the granddaughter to David.
Yes, his mother was an Ammonitess. So Solomon had married those women from those other nations. So you're right, Brother Allen, that he married, he married a lot of women, but the wife that he had that was the mother of his son Abijah that was going to succeed him. She was David's granddaughter, but through Absalom. And of course, Absalom was the son of a woman that David married that was of royalty from another nation, and so that was a problem with part of the background with Absalom. We know what happened with him, and so. So there's that. He's got the influence from his wives, and that one in particular, as that was his favorite wife. But also from his mother, who was an Ammonitess that Solomon had married. So there was a lot there in his background as far as influences around him that would have been in a direction away from the Lord. So he had those family influences. We already know something about the advisors that he had that were his peers that he listened to, and their counsel wasn't good. But then also the removal of the most positive influence he had in his life, and that was his father Solomon. And his father, of course, had forsaken the Lord in his later years, but repented of that. And we have the book of Ecclesiastes with Solomon's instructions to everybody, to us included, as it's the Lord's instructions through him. But the conclusion of the whole matter, and that's to fear God and keep his commandments. Everything else is vanity and vexation of spirit. He counseled the young to remember their Creator in the days of their youth, also in that last and 12th chapter of Ecclesiastes. And we know that those instructions would have been there for his son at that time too. And evidently there was, with that good influence there, it was enough to sustain him for 3 years. But Solomon's been gone now for that period of time. And what kind of influence is there in his life for good that was on the level with what he had from his father? And it's just not there. He's got those other influences, and that certainly is not doing him any good spiritually. So, and there's lots to that, and so many of the lessons that we already looked at and studied in detail with Solomon, with what happened with him. As wise as he was, when he married all those women from other nations, was he able to withstand those influences and overcome all of that that was there? Or did it also affect him greatly? I mean, it turned his heart from God. And the Lord tells us very plainly that that happened to him. And if we follow the same steps as he walked in, if we marry ourselves with those of the world that aren't believers, then I mean those influences are going to affect us in the wrong way too, and children, as we can see that happening with Solomon. Even though he recovered himself, I mean, what's happening now to his son? And he's no longer around to do anything about that, even though he repented. Is he able to be there for his son at this time anymore? He's gone. And his son has is now going off and forsaking the Lord. And there's we don't read of any recovery or any repentance on Rehoboam's part. So there are lots there, even though Solomon escaped with his own soul. Look at all the influences of what happened and the repercussions for his family and for the entire nation or kingdom of Israel. I mean, as a result of the things that Solomon did with the women that he married, we can see the effects on his family right here. But what about the whole nation? I mean, would there have been the split in the kingdom without that? Would you have had Jeroboam? I mean, Jeroboam, God raised up as an adversary to Solomon because of those sins. Would you have had a Jeroboam? Would you have had a split in the kingdom? Would you have had all these things that we've been reading about ever since chapter 11 of 1 Kings when Solomon turned away from the Lord at that time? Would you have had any of these things? And now this spiritual decline of the entire nation and 10 tribes that, with the exception of that minority of faithful ones that left, the majority of those 10 tribes forsook the Lord, followed Jeroboam, and they never departed from those sins until later they're carried away into captivity by the Assyrians, never to return. So you can look at all the ripples or repercussions down the line for generations from what Solomon did. Was when he repented, was he able to forestall or avoid all of those consequences that were going to come? No. So there's so much to be reminded of as far as those lessons and the things that can happen and the influences that can come upon us that can affect many, many people and last for many generations in those issues about who we marry, who our children marry, and those things. So very, very serious matters these are. So we get the reminders of this all along here. And it's going to be, as we have gotten into chapter 12 already in our study, and we see what happened to Rehoboam after those 3 years, and we're going to see now the reasons why, where, what happened, why he was, because we have to ask the question, well, why did he leave? Why did he forsake the Lord after those 3 years? Well, we see the background that he gave us there in chapter 11 that we know about, and those negative influences that were there in his life from his mother, from his wives, and others. But he tells us in the beginning of chapter 12 that when Rehoboam had established a kingdom and had strengthened himself, when everything was going well because God was blessing him because he followed the Lord, then he forsook the law of the Lord and all Israel with him. So when he went bad, well, again, his choice affected many others too. Well, look at how weak Israel was, and this also goes back to what Solomon had done. But when Solomon came back, was he able to pull the nation back around, or at least many of them, where they were turning back to the Lord? Well, yeah, they followed Rehoboam. He pulled Rehoboam back and the people with him, and it lasted for those 3 years. But how strong were they? Obviously not very. And with that influence now gone from Solomon, and with weak Rehoboam there, I mean, how much does it take for the whole nation then to go back again in the wrong direction? All Israel went with it. So it just has not been enough time, a long enough time, and there's not enough strength there. They don't resist that pull. The devil is working against all of them. Brother Tom?
It's the same. It's the actuality of the warning we're seeing, the parable of the sower.
Yes.
That is what it is.
Yeah. And in this case, there are a lot of those worldly influences. There's the there's a lot of thorns there, spiritual thorns, and that's a very good point there about it. And there's a lot of choking of the good plant here, and that's what he's going to get into that a little bit further. He's going to talk about some more about what happened with Rehoboam and why he went bad. And what we can learn to how to avoid that. A big part of that, as we've already mentioned, is, well, who are our influences? Who have we married? Who's in our children's lives? Who's in our lives? Who are our influences? And because we can see how much that's going to affect us. And this is also a reminder that none of us are islands. None of us are by ourselves, where what we do and the choices we make, where they don't affect other people. If we're not using good judgment, and if we're making wrong choices, it's going to involve a lot of different people. It will affect our families. It will affect our spiritual family. We being spiritual Israel, as we see it affected physical Israel there, but if we make choices in our lives, it will have repercussions on others, and it can do a lot of damage. So there are many reasons that we have to think about those things, not just for our own sake, but we have to think about how that's going to impact others and our families and beyond. Also along with that, of course, we have to recognize what we do in terms of when things are going well, because what the devil attacks here, at what point in Rehoboam, when is he able to have this success? It says when Rehoboam had established the kingdom and had strengthened himself. So there are going to be times when things come together and things are at a good point for us in our lives. Is that time to relax? No, not spiritually speaking. We can't. We can't afford to do that at any time. And we need to always be looking around, because even at those best of moments. I mean, the devil's going to be looking for an opportunity to destroy all of that. And he took a point at when Israel, when they were strong and they were going in the right direction, but he's attacking them right there and is successful at it. So we can see again how the devil works, how he operates, and he's not going to let up on us at all. So we can expect him to do everything that he can to try to destroy us and destroy our families and to destroy the church. He's going to do whatever he can to cause as much damage to as many souls as possible. And when things are going well, he's not going to. To let up then. I mean, he was. How are things for Job when he got after Job so hard? Of course, the Lord asked him, "Have you considered my servant Job?" And we can see it's the Lord's will for those trials to come. And so, when we're at a high point, we can expect the trials to be coming. But if we can see the pattern of how the devil works and. They failed the test here. So in the fifth year of King Rehoboam, there in verse 2 of 2 Chronicles 12, Shishak, the king of Egypt, came up against Israel because they had transgressed against the Lord. So God sent this adversary there, and he brought a lot with him. Those ones from, he came from Egypt, but he brought those ones from his allies, from some of those other areas in northern Africa, and they attacked Israel and took the fence cities that pertained to Jerusalem, and they came up to Jerusalem. I mean, came to Judah, and then they came to Jerusalem in verse 4. So chapter 11 described the building of those fence cities and the strengthening of them. But when they forsook the Lord, and then the Lord was going after them here to punish them for it. How well did those, or how long did those fenced cities last? What could their defenses do? In this case, were their defenses really against these Egyptians and other nations with them that came? Who was the one that sent them? So who were they? Who were these defenses really? Who would they be resisting at this point, actually? The Lord. How effective was that? Now, when God was on their side, those fenced cities were great, weren't they? Because it was the Lord behind them. So the Lord could use that to help them when they were doing well. I mean, they had an army, didn't they? They had an army, they had defense cities, and when they were following the Lord, all those things worked well because God blessed it to do so. And anybody that was fighting against them would have been fighting against the Lord. And we've seen many examples. I mean, really, how big did their army need to be and how strong did their fence cities need to be able to resist their enemies when the Lord was on their side? Remember 1 Samuel 14 with Jonathan and his armor bearer? The two of them went and just with the two of them, they took out a garrison of the Philistines that then led to an entire wipeout of the Philistines at that time. And three chapters later in 1 Samuel 17, we know about David and Goliath and what happened with that. And they both spoke the same words about how the Lord was able to save with few. They didn't need a lot. We also have those lessons and elsewhere. I mean, how many did Gideon need to destroy that entire army of the Midianites? Well, God gave him 300, but did he actually even need 300? But God did that in that way to make that lesson very clear that it was the Lord. So, I mean, how much does the Lord need to be able to defeat the enemies? Joshua and Caleb understood that when they went in as spies into Canaan. It didn't matter to them how big the people were, how many there were, how big the walls of their cities were, any of those other things. They understood God was on their side, so none of those things mattered. God was going to fulfill his promise. If they obeyed him, they had no doubt that God was going to do what he said he would do. The others did not believe, though. But anyway, here we can see those fenced cities, when they forsook the Lord, those fenced cities fall immediately. Didn't do them any good at that point because they would have been resisting or fighting against God. Even Gamaliel in Acts chapter 5, when the apostles were imprisoned by the Jewish leaders, the high priest and his people, trying to prevent them from being able to teach and preach Christ there in the temple in Jerusalem and in their nation. And then while they were getting ready, they go and call them out to bring them before them to have their whatever their trial was going to be. And they went to fetch them, and they weren't in there because God had let them out of the prison. They were back in the temple teaching and preaching. So how well were their efforts to stop that? Gamaliel then spoke up when they brought them back in there and said to leave them alone, because they said if they were doing what they were teaching and doing was false, then what was going to happen? God would take care of it, and it would be defeated. But he said, if it is the Lord, for them to try to resist it, he says, then they were in the position of fighting against God. And he knew that would not succeed. Gamaliel, by the way, was the one that had trained whom? Paul. Saul of Tarsus, that became the Apostle Paul. He was brought up at his feet. But in Acts 5, that was what his counsel was. He recognized God was going to take care of it one way or the other. If it was something evil, he would defeat them. They didn't need to do it. But if it was from God, then they would have been futilely resisting God, which is what they did. They didn't listen to him. And it was in vain, and they failed. But fighting against God never works. But if God be for us, what does Romans 8 say? Who can be against us? What can separate us from the love of God? Principalities, powers, is there anything, anybody that can do that? Mm-mm. So we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us. And but if we forsake the Lord and he's going against us, we're going to fall. But when this happens and he brings Shishak against Israel, well, as we had mentioned before when we read this, the fact that they had an enemy to come against them and to take their fenced cities, based on what God had promised them with the blessings and curses, Deuteronomy chapter 28 is one very long chapter that's full of those things. Back in Moses' time, when he gave them the law and said, if you keep these commandments, here's what will happen. Here's how the Lord will bless you. If you don't keep these commandments, here's what God is going to do to you to punish you for that. And it included the things about their about famine. I mean, there would be none if they followed the Lord. They would have famine if they forsook the Lord. Their crops would be blessed. Their animals would be fruitful. All those things physically God promised to bless them with and sustain them. And if they kept his commandments, but then they would lose all of that if they forsook it. And as concerning their enemies, he said, if you keep my commandments, your enemies are going to come against you one way and flee before you seven ways. But if you forsake me and do not keep my commandments, you will go after your enemies one way and flee seven ways. All those things were in there in Deuteronomy 28 and other places where God had told them, here's what's going to happen. If you keep my commandments, here's what's going to happen if you don't. So right now they have an enemy come against them, take their fenced cities and come right up against Jerusalem. With nothing else other than what they already knew from what God had said in his word when he gave them their law, the word they already had, were the circumstances alone, could that or should that have been sufficient for them to say, we've messed up. We must be doing something wrong here. Because God said if something like this happens, that will only happen if we're forsaking him and not obeying him. We better look at ourselves and see what we've done wrong. Now, can you think of an example where something like that happened and someone from the circumstances got the message? Well, David. You remember they had a famine, and it was because the Gibeonites, going all the way back to the book of Joshua in chapter 9 of that book, that's when the Israelites were tricked by the Gibeonites, who were Canaanite neighbors. The Lord had said not to make a covenant with any of those cities, any of those nations of Canaan. Well, the Gibeonites saw what happened with first Jericho and then Ai as they were completely and utterly destroyed as God had commanded. and they were in the crosshairs. I mean, they would have been right up there, likely to be next, and they saw that, and they did not want to have the same thing happen to them that happened to those others. So they decided to. They concocted a story where they got old clothes and rags and all of that, and then came up to the Israelites and said they had journeyed from a far country, and then wanted to make a league with them. Well, Joshua and the elders of Israel did so without consulting with the Lord, who would have obviously told them who they were and not to listen to that deception. But they fell for it, and so they made a covenant that they would not destroy them. And so once they made that covenant, were they bound to it? Yes, and that was permanently for the duration of the nation of Israel. So centuries later, which would have been somewhere on the order of 450 to 500 years later, King Saul comes along and he kills some of them. Now God didn't bring a famine immediately at that time. What good would that have done as far as trying to make that situation right with Saul? I mean, Saul wasn't listening to anything, was he? Nothing from the Lord at anyhow. So that wasn't going to make that situation right. So after Saul was dead of all the consequences of his disobedience anyhow, David comes in. Well, then the Lord brought the famine. And David immediately recognizes something's wrong here, and we're not going to have a famine unless there's something in our nation that's not right with the Lord. What's going on? What's the problem? And he found out the problem was revealed, and he did something about it. So David recognized the circumstance, put that together. Well, this can only happen if there's a spiritual problem, and then he sought from the Lord to find out what it was so he could fix it, and he did. Well, should Rehoboam and the people, or could they have done the same thing here? Yeah. But the circumstance itself was a teacher. But the Lord also sent a prophet. So how easy did he make it for them? Well, he made it very easy. He sent Shemaiah, this prophet, there in verse 5 of 2 Chronicles 12. And to Rehoboam and the princes of Judah. And said to them, "Thus saith the Lord, you have forsaken me, and therefore have I also left you in the hand of Shishak." So he told them plainly, where they didn't even have to try to connect the dots themselves. The Lord connected all the dots for them. Here's what I'm doing, and here's why. So it's put to them exactly like that. So what are they going to do about it? Well, verse 6 says that they humble themselves. And they said, "The Lord is righteous." And so in verse 7, when the Lord saw that they humbled themselves, then he sent Shemaiah back to them and said, "They have humbled themselves, therefore I will not destroy them, but I will grant them some deliverance. And my wrath will not be poured out upon Jerusalem by the hand of Shishak." Did he give them full deliverance? He gave them some deliverance. He gave them a deliverance that was essentially proportional to the humility. They humbled themselves some in that situation. They acknowledged the Lord was righteous. So they showed that humility, and the Lord gave them some deliverance. They did not face utter destruction at that time. The Lord gives his favor to the humble, doesn't he? And we have a situation that comes up a bit later as far as sequence in time in Israel, when wicked Ahab is king, and the Lord's prophet Elijah was sent to him about what the evil things that he had done, and then Ahab humbled himself. At that time, it was not a full repentance by any stretch, but there was some humility shown there, and that's in 1 Kings chapter 21, which we'll get to later in our study. But at that time, when Elijah came and prophesied there, that it says in 1 Kings chapter 21 and verse 20, 7, it came to pass when Ahab heard these words that he rent his clothes and put a sackcloth upon his flesh and fasted and lay in sackcloth and went softly. And the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, "Seest thou how Ahab humbleth himself before me? Because he humbleth himself before me, I will not bring the evil in his days, but in his son's days will I bring the evil upon his house." So God responded even to that little bit of humility that Ahab showed. Did Ahab repent and turn to the Lord and forsake all of his sins? No. But he did humble himself and go softly when he heard that prophecy against his house for his wickedness. He humbled himself to a certain degree, and God gave a reward to him for that amount of humility. And that was that he would bring the destruction after his days. That was not going to spare Ahab from the prophecy that the Lord made against him specifically, and that the dogs would lick up his blood in Jezreel, in the place where they licked up the blood of Naboth, whose vineyard Ahab took. And that was fulfilled. So he died the violent death that the Lord had prophesied as his punishment. But the destruction of all of his family, that came after that death of Ahab. And the reason of the timing of that was because of that that small amount of humility that he showed. So if God would respond to a little humility in a man as wicked as Ahab, and he responds to some humility shown here by Rehoboam, who has forsaken the Lord, I mean, how much reward will God give to us if we humble ourselves fully under his hand and repent of any and all wickedness that may be within us and seek to keep all of his commandments? Will the Lord respond to that? Will he give his grace to those who humble themselves? Yes, that's his promise. So we see some examples like that, even in cases like this with some ones that do not even repent fully. Ahab particularly, and also now in this case, Rehoboam. So God did provide some deliverance there. So Shishak did not utterly destroy Jerusalem because of the fact that Rehoboam and the princes of Judah humbled themselves in that situation. But there was still punishment. So there was some deliverance because of the humility, but there's also going to be some enduring punishment because they have not fully repented and turned to the Lord and their consequences for their evil. Verse 8 of 2 Chronicles 12 says, "Nevertheless, they shall be his servants, that they may know my service and the service of the kingdom of the countries." So were they still worthy of further punishment and admonition from the Lord? More chastening? Yeah, they were worthy of that, and God provided it. But he did not give them utter destruction because they humbled themselves at least to a certain degree there. So let's go ahead and read here from verse 9 a little bit here. Verses 9 through, we'll look at 9 through 12 here in 2 Chronicles chapter 12. And let's see, we'll ask Brother Dave to read that. 2 Chronicles 12, 9 through 12.
"So Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem and took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. He took all. He carried away also the shields of gold which Solomon had made, instead of which King Rehoboam made shields of brass and committed them to the hands of the chief of the guard that kept the entrance of the king's house. And when the king entered into the house of the Lord, the guard came and fetched them and brought them again into the guard chamber. And when he humbled himself, the wrath of the Lord turned from him, that he would not destroy him altogether. And also in Judah things went well."
Okay, so that summarizes what's going on in Judah up to this point. But the high point that was reached in Israel under David and Solomon, is it ever going to be matched or equaled for the remainder of the history of the nation? No. I mean, the closest that will come is after the captivity returns from Babylon. I mean, there are going to be a few good points in between where things are going to be better than this. But I mean, how many righteous kings will there be in Judah in the future from here? I mean, Rehoboam is number one of 19 kings, the first of 19 that will rule over the southern kingdom. And of those, the 19th, the final one was Zedekiah, who was the last son of Josiah. But between Rehoboam and Zedekiah, I mean, all 19 of those were descendants of David, sitting on David's throne, ruling over the kingdom of Judah. But of those 19, how many of them were righteous? Fully. So that means not where they started off, because, I mean, somebody might say, well, Rehoboam had three good years. Yeah. But what happened after that? He forsook the Lord. So, and we're not told of any, we've got that measure of humility at that point in time, but it wasn't full. So we can't count Rehoboam as being one who served the Lord like David. And his son Abijah does not. His grandson Asa does. And then his son Jehoshaphat. And then later we have Hezekiah and Josiah. That's it. There are a few others, a handful of others, about four others, that started off serving the Lord for a time and then forsook him, much like the pattern of Rehoboam. But there are only four of the 19 kings of Judah that served the Lord fully. Well, but what's going on in the rest of the nation when they are serving the Lord, or even within their kingdom? All right, for example, when Asa and Jehoshaphat are kings of Judah, what's going on in the northern kingdom? You still have those kings up there following in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. They don't repent of that. So we don't see the entire nation serving the Lord during the time where you have the rare times when you had a righteous king just over part of the kingdom, or one of the kingdoms. They never did have a righteous one in the north. That's the point. So not under Asa, not under Jehoshaphat, and you get to Hezekiah's time, and that's when Hoshea is the final king of the northern kingdom, and that's when they're taken away into captivity, never to return. So those tribes are lost forever. So even under Hezekiah, he was a righteous king, and the kingdom turned to the Lord under him, but that's his kingdom. The rest of the nation is lost. So that doesn't match up with David's time. Josiah, he was a righteous king, compelled his kingdom to follow the Lord, but they only did so feignedly. We're told that in Jeremiah chapter 3. They were faking it. They only did it because they were made to. So, and even his own children, after he died, three of his children, well, he had a son, Jehoahaz, and then Jehoiakim, who were the next two kings. Jehoahaz was wicked and was carried away into Egypt after he'd only been king for a few months. Jehoiakim becomes king for several years. He's the one that cut up the scroll that Jeremiah wrote, cut it up, threw it in the fire to burn it up. And his punishment was his body wasn't buried. It was left out into the elements outside of the gate of Jerusalem. The Lord prophesied that end for him. He was killed. His son, which was Josiah's grandson, Jehoiachin, also known as Jeconiah, he was carried away into captivity. And then Zedekiah, the youngest son of Josiah, became the last king of Judah. He was evil. He was the one that had his eyes plucked out. His children were killed before his eyes, before they were plucked out. And then he was carried off and he was killed. So even Josiah, that's a summary of Josiah's own family. So even his own children and grandchild did not serve the Lord, neither did the rest of his kingdom. When the captivity returns, they had repented. But again, that's the remnant only of really Judah and a few of those tribes that had joined them. But as far as the northern kingdom, they were lost forever. So when do we see a time in Israel where it's ever going to match? We have the whole nation, all the tribes following the Lord like they did under David and Solomon. It'll never be equal. There are many ways in which we can see the benchmarks or some descriptions that remind us of that. Well, look at that temple that Solomon made and all that was in it. What starts happening here under Rehoboam? All the glory that with all the gold in there, that's starting to get stripped out, isn't it? So here go those shields of gold, they're replaced with shields of brass. How does that compare? So there are lots of ways that we can see descriptions that remind us or measure how there's this decline in the nation. There's just another one right there. So, but nevertheless, the Lord did reward and preserve them according to that measure of humility they showed in that instance. But that wasn't full. What does he tell us next there? We'll go ahead and read these last four verses of chapter 12. We'll have to try to wrap up what he tells us in there, especially the key point of verse 14 is what we want to really study in some more detail next week. But we'll go ahead and preview it by reading down there from 13 through 16, Brother Glenn.
So King Rehoboam strengthened himself in Jerusalem and reigned. And Rehoboam was 140 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 17 years in Jerusalem. The city was the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel. He put his name there. And his mother's name was Naamah, the Ammonites. And he did evil because he prepared by his heart to seek the Lord. And after Rehoboam, first and last, had not written in the book of Shemaiah, the prophet, and Ahilu, the seer, concerning genealogies. And there were wars between Rehoboam and Jericho.
Is there some point to a reason why the Lord keeps reminding us of who his mother was? That should be pretty obvious. His mother was Naamah and Ammonitis. So in the midst of this description of what's going on, I mean, what is the next thing he says about Rehoboam right after that statement or that reminder again of who his mother was, even though he told us about that in the previous chapter? Comes back to that and then says what?
He did evil.
So there is a direct connection there. And he did evil. And what's the reason why? It says because he prepared not his heart to seek the Lord. So when we ask the question, what went wrong with Rehoboam? We see those influences there, but we see the bottom line with him. I mean, was there anything he could have done to have overcome the influences there? Well, let's ask another way of asking that question. I mean, all of us have influences in our lives, good and bad. Any one of us, the devil wants us to let this world influence us and let different ones that are, I mean, they're people that, all of us have people in our own families that aren't followers of the Lord like they should be. I mean, those relationships are their connections. There's lots of ways in which Satan will try to get at us, and through our family is the chief way. So often, as the Lord even told us it would be, that a man's foes would be those of his own household. Well, the devil's going to use that. He's going to try to get us, to pull us away from him any way that he can, through the enticements of the world and different ones that are in our lives. Well, do we all have an excuse? Can we just go into the world and follow sin and pleasure and just say, well, that's because there's just too much influence there for me to overcome. It's not my fault. Brother Tom?
Well, maybe he'll give us a means of escape and I'm not going to look for it.
Well, and that's right. The bottom line, though, the way we can overcome that is by preparing our hearts to seek the Lord. There is a way to overcome all of that. But we have to do something. We have to prepare our hearts to seek the Lord so that whoever it is, whether it's our own mother, in the case of Rehoboam, later on we're going to see Rehoboam's grandson, who is Asa, Well, his mother puts an idol in the temple. And Asa doesn't follow that. In fact, he boots her out from being queen because of it. What's the difference between Asa and Rehoboam? And he's going to bring that up. Asa prepared his heart to seek the Lord. Rehoboam didn't. So you can see it's not, well, my mother wasn't very good, or she was just too much for me to open. No. Rehoboam didn't prepare his heart to seek the Lord. But Asa did. So, I mean, there's no excuse. There's no excuse for us not to seek and follow the Lord. But we have to do what Rehoboam didn't do. We have to prepare our hearts to seek the Lord. So that's what we want to go into much more detail on, Lord willing, next week or next time as we study this. And then we'll try to wrap up chapter 12 there. And then we'll, Lord willing, have the opportunity to get back into some more of what we have in 1 Kings with what's going on after the end of the house of Jeroboam and the fulfillment of the prophecies against his family and what happens in the northern kingdom from there. So that's what's next, Lord willing. So look forward to continuing that later. Let's go ahead.